The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Welcome to Work Party, the podcast where we are throwing out the rule book and bringing you real talk and hot takes on what is happening in the working world right now, because life moves fast. If we've learned anything from the past few years, it's that the only constant is change, and we can't pretend everything is status quo. I'm your host, Jacqueline Johnson, and it's Hot Take Time, where we ask guests to let us in on a fresh POV that they feel super passionate about. From spicy money talk to unexpected relationship advice, love them or hate them, agree or disagree, these piping hot and sometimes controversial takes will get you thinking. So let's get into it. On today's episode, I'm joined by Jing Gao, the CEO and founder of Fly by Jing, a line of Chinese spices and condiments inspired by the flavors in Jing's hometown of Chengdu. The brand has quickly become a cult favorite with its products featured in top restaurants and publications worldwide. Jing told us when she was on our Create and Cultivate 100 list earlier this year, our mission is to evolve culture through taste and elevate consciousness by expanding palates and minds. But Jing's journey to success was not easy. She faced a number of challenges along the way, but she persevered. And today, Fly by Jing is one of the most successful female-led food brands in the world. And Jing is here to talk about her success and how it's perceived by those around us and ourselves, and talk about her new book. So welcome, Jing.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we are going to do a hot take episode with you. So what is your hot take?
Okay, so one of my many hot takes is that what may look like a failure to everyone else can still be a success to you.
I love it. Well, first of all, feel free to bring multiple hot takes to the table. We love that. But can you tell us a little bit about why this is your hot take?
Yeah, I think, you know, from the outside, our journey has been pretty quick and, you know, it's looked like a real big success, but there's been so many points of, you know, highs and lows and failures in between. And, you know, any one of those could have had the power maybe to kind of end the journey for us. But, you know, from every lesson you grow, and there's endless failures along the journey, and couldn't have been, you know, couldn't have gotten here without them. So
I totally agree. I think, you know, obviously we're living in social media world where everything looks like, you know, the perfect situation, the amazing exit, the this, that, the other. And no one really knows all the things that go on behind the scenes. But let's go back to the beginning. Tell me about starting the company and what inspired you to do this.
Yeah. Well, I would have to probably go back even further. So before I started Fly by Jing, I had a restaurant. I used to live in Shanghai. It was my first venture out on my own. Had a business partner. I was like in my mid-20s.
Wow.
And it really taught me a lot of lessons that led to Fly by Jing. But before I even talk about that, I'll, you know, kind of share the story of how I came into food and Chinese food in the first place.
Yeah.
So I was born in Chengdu, but I grew up moving around a lot. My parents were academics. We moved with their jobs to all over Europe and Canada. And every year of my life, I was like moving to a different country, speaking a different language, trying to fit in.
Mm.
And so from a very young age, I even took on a Western name to try to adapt and try to fit in. So I was Jenny for most of my life.
Wow.
Yeah, because like the kids could not pronounce my name.
Right.
And so I just tried my best to blend in. It wasn't until I was in my 20s that I ended up in Asia, in China, for a job. I used to work in tech. So I moved over for a job. And that's where I started to kind of like reconnect with my roots and peel back the layers and figure out who am I, because I didn't realize it at the time, but so many years of kind of code switching, kind of pushing down who I was has really made me lose a sense of, of what that is. And so for me, food actually interestingly became a vehicle for me to peel back those layers. And I just became obsessed with Chinese food, the depth of it, this 5,000 year culinary heritage, and was kind of like really desperate to like find a sense of my own voice and expression through Chinese food.
Mm.
And that led me to a million things. Like one was, you know, just taking people on food tours, writing about it. I had a food blog that was one of the few food blogs in the English language about Chinese food. And then celebrity chefs would call me up to be their on-screen guide when they would come to China to film. And so one thing just kind of led to another. And I eventually quit my job. And this opportunity came to start a restaurant. And I learned a lot of lessons through that. One was, you know, you really have to be very careful who you pick your business partners mm-hmm. with, because it is more intense than a marriage, right? Oh, you can divorce.
Absolutely.
You know, I was young, naive. I thought, you know, if I had the ideas, if I worked hard, that was it. But I learned the hard way that when there's money involved, ego sometimes gets involved as well. And so what ended up happening was my business partner pushed me out of the business after I really had like built the majority of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of really bitter lessons there. But I think I kind of dove right back into food. I was just like, okay, you know what? I'm unfazed, because even though I've worked on this for 2.5 years, even though it was an extremely successful business, we were, you know, winning awards. We were on top 10 lists, like not just in China, but internationally. I had the confidence of, you know, the experience that I'd gathered, right? Like I had built the restaurant from scratch. I had come up with a concept. I had done the storytelling that attracted so much media attention and all of that. So I knew that the next thing I did would be even bigger and better. And so
I love that attitude, by the way. I feel like that's such a specific attitude for an entrepreneur. You have to be resilient. And I love that you didn't diminish your worth based on that experience, which can be very easy to do.
Yeah, I would say I definitely gained confidence in one respect. But then in the other respect, I definitely also, you know, felt that fear of like partnership again, right? And like trusting again. And so when I started my next business, which ended up being Fly by Jing, as you can tell, I was very adamant that the company belonged to me. It had my name in it.
Put my name on it, okay? I love that. I love it.
And I definitely, I think, you know, kind of veered over to too much on the other end, where I held too much control for too long.
But that makes sense.
Yeah.
that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a journey. Yeah.
Yeah. So my first business, I had a really gnarly business partner breakup. So I totally understand. And even with Create and Cultivate, like building it, I was like so protective at the beginning. Yeah. And then eventually you let people in, you get a real good lawyer.
Yeah.
and then there you go. So I love that. So now you are starting Fly by Jing. Were you always like, it's going to be an Asian condiment business? Or were you kind of like toying with opening a restaurant? Like, what were you toying with?
Yeah, no, I just was exploring at first. And I did. And for me, that was starting from the beginning. I went to Chengdu and I studied with this master chef there. He was like incredible Michelin level chef. I studied with him and I was like, let me just learn everything I can first. The thing about Chinese cuisine is that most people don't know, China's more of a continent. It's so massive.
Yeah.
And all of the different regions are so diverse and so different. So it's like comparing, you know, German cuisine to Spanish cuisine. Like you just can't.
Right.
And so for me, it was like, okay, how can I really get to the truth of what I want to express? And really for me, that was like getting back to my roots, which is my hometown. So there I learned all sorts of like techniques and, you know, the craft, but also about ingredients and, you know, how important these ingredients are to the flavors. And, you know, that, you know, any one ingredient has a million different grades of quality. And really, if you want the highest quality flavor, it's rare, it's hard to get, but it really transforms the flavor of what you're cooking. So through that, you know, the study, I was able to make relationships with these incredible farmers, incredible suppliers of ingredients that, you know, were just like nothing I'd ever tasted. And I realized most of these ingredients had never made its way out of China or even like outside of those top tier chef circles, because they're so high in demand and so rare. Then I started cooking with it and I started just kind of making it my own. How do I, you know, express something that was unique to my own voice? You know, I didn't know anyone like myself that was born in China, but grew up in like 8 countries and like Canadian, but living in Shanghai. And for me, I tried to make it work for myself. And so when I started Fly by Jing, it was actually an underground supper club. I wanted to just have fun with it.
Yeah.
And the name Fly is a reference to a type of restaurant in Chengdu called Fly restaurants. And these are hole in the walls that are so delicious. They attract people like flies. So it's like a very quirky, fun way to describe, you know, just how food obsessed people in Chengdu are. People are just absolutely obsessed. And so I wanted to create that energy, that same, you know, sense, that vibrancy. in my cooking. So it started as a supper club, which then led to pop-ups. And I was doing pop-ups with other chefs in different cities, amazing. Chefs who were cooking Italian food, Mexican food. And we would kind of like combine the flavors. And
cool.
I really found that Sichuan flavors worked on any canvas, right? It's just incredible flavor profiles that, you know, when I would travel to New Zealand, we would apply it to like local ingredients. And through that process was kind of how I got the first insight that there is demand for these flavors. People love them. They just had no access to it. So that's what got me thinking, like, how do I make it more accessible? How do I bring it to a wider audience?
Yeah. So what year is this when you're doing the pop-ups?
This is 2017, 2018.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when do you take the leap into product? Because what I am loving about this story and getting back to the hot take of failure is, like, you're kind of unafraid to just go into different categories, like, that you know, like, really don't have any, like, formal training in, which I love, right? So it's like, yeah, I'm going to go open a restaurant. I'm 24 years old. Like, I'm going to go do this. Yeah. And you live, you learn, you make mistakes along the way. You do these supper clubs. They obviously take off. You learn a lot. And you're like, I'm going to launch a product. So take us through that process and some of the lessons and maybe failures along the way.
Yeah. So I think it was like Steve Jobs that said, like, when you look back at your life, the dots connect, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can't connect it at the time. So for me, it's like every single experience, every single step really led to what I'm doing now. And at the time, it wasn't planned. It's not like I had a master plan that I'm going to start this condiment brand.
Totally.
But, you know, I think every step also leads to, like, reveals the path ahead, right? So for me, I was trying to do as much as I could to see what stuck with not just, like, the audience, but with me, like, what made me light up. And for me, it was like, you know, sharing these flavors and seeing people's faces light up when they tried it. And also, the more I studied, you know, Chinese food and the, you know, complexity and how sophisticated it was, the more I realized also how little people in the West knew about
it.
And not just how little they knew about it, but the additional bias they had against it, right? So there's this perception that Chinese food is low quality, it's cheap, it's not worth, you know, value. And I really became obsessed with shifting that narrative. For me, the product really came from a trip that I took in the U.S. This was 2018. I hadn't spent a lot of time here because I'm Canadian. So I ended up with a friend traveling through California. We were here in March, and this was this coincided with an annual trade show called Expo West.
Yes.
So have you been to Expo West?
Yes. So for people who are listening who don't know what Expo West is, could you give it like a quick overview?
Yeah. So I think it's like the biggest food trade show in the world. It's massive. It's at the Anaheim Convention Center every March.
Huge.
And there's literally 5,000 like vendors, people who are basically showcasing their different food items that are at the forefront of, like, you know, the next trends, the healthiest foods. And the people walking the halls are the gatekeepers to how America eats, right? These are the Whole Foods buyers, the Sprouts buyers, and et cetera. And they are selecting basically what's going to go on shelves for the next few years and determine how people eat. And so when I was there, I was just amazed by, like, how much there was. Like, it's very overwhelming,
right? Absolutely, yeah.
There's, like, samples everywhere, and you're, like, eating,
like,
yourself
cookies,
sick.
Cookies, snacks, sauces, like, every sort of innovation, like mushroom jerky. You're just like, what's happening?
Exactly. But so in 2018, I was really shocked after spending, like, 3 or 4 days there that I saw only 3 or 4 Asian food brands.
Right.
And that was really shocking because I was reading these industry reports at the time that, you know, a lot of the growth in natural food was going to come from multicultural flavors.
Yeah.
That's what people want. And people want more diversity. People want more flavor. And a lot of flavor comes with spice, right? And heat. And that was basically not present.
Right.
And not only that, you know, there was a very little diversity in even the people who are walking the hall. So I knew that, you know, there was basically a barrier, right, to access. So that was in March of 2018. And at the time, so I mentioned I was doing these pop-up dinners all over the world. And what I often had to do was carry ingredients with me in my suitcase, because the ingredients were the essential component to the flavors.
Right.
And so obviously I couldn't access it in, like, Japan or anywhere.
Yeah.
So I eventually started making these sauce bases, like flavor bases for some of my key dishes. Chili crisp was actually the derivative of one of those, right? So it was like an oil-based chili sauce that I could layer into a lot of dishes to add that extra flavor that gives you that shortcut to real deep umami flavor. So chili crisp, zhong sauce, mala spice, they were all, you know, that's how they all initially started. And then I realized that, like, the chili crisp, I mean, chili crisp as a condiment, so for people who don't know, it's the most popular hot sauce in China, in Asia. It is an oil-based dried chili condiment that's spicy, crispy, savory, umami, you know. There's a lot of different things that could be in it, and there's literally thousands of varieties in China. Every family makes their own.
Mm.
I grew up eating, you know, my family's version, which differs from every other family's. And most people don't really buy it on shelves because usually, you know, that store-bought, you know, versions are inferior. They're like laden with preservatives and, you know, flavor additives. So you want to kind of make it at home. So I realized that, like, this was my version of a chili crisp.
Mm-hmm.
And people started asking for it in Shanghai. I started bottling it and selling it locally. And so at the time when I was at Expo West, I was kind of just connecting the dots, like maybe this could work.
Right.
In the U.S.
Yeah.
And I tested that theory with a Kickstarter at first.
Nice.
So I spent about, I don't know, 2 months kind of filming this video, building this page. I had had some friends that had successful Kickstarters, so I asked them, like, how do you
What's the roadmap?
There's, you know, what I realized was there's a blueprint for, like, how do you do a successful Kickstarter, right? So I really studied it, and in July of that year, I launched the Kickstarter, and, you know, cold reached out to several editors who I knew were interested in Chinese food. They ended up all writing about it.
Amazing.
So on the day that it launched, it went viral and became one of the highest funded craft food projects on the platform.
Gosh, how much did you raise on Kickstarter?
So in total, Kickstarter and another platform, I think it was close to 200,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Congrats.
So, and these were, you know, I was selling the jars, pre-selling the jars. For $25. So people were, like, thousands of people had ordered this without having tasted it.
Right, right.
Which I think is a testament to, you know, my story, which was that I wanted to elevate Chinese cuisine. I wanted to show how high quality this could be. You know, my background as a chef in China, but also that I think we're ready for a new paradigm about Chinese food, right?
100%.
And I think everybody was ready. So that was sort of proof that I think there's a market. And then after this successful Kickstarter, it's kind of like the hard work begins.
Yeah, yeah.
Now
exactly.
I have to figure out, how do I scale this? How do I, you know, scale it beyond my little kitchen in Shanghai? So that was a whole other journey laden with failures and, you know, hilarious antics and stories, and looking for a factory that would produce our sauces and maintain the quality level that I wanted was incredibly difficult.
I can imagine.
I basically just started calling up factories. I, like, looked them up online. In China, any food product, you're required to put, like, the name of the factory on it. So I basically went to the grocery store, found every jar of sauce I could find, called them up, and was told no probably, like, hundreds of times.
Wow.
Because sauce making and condiment making is such a huge industry in China. And they're just like, who are you?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
We have clients that are, like, you know, multi-million dollar, you
100-year-old.
Exactly.
Make millions.
Like, who are you?
Yeah.
So I had to, like, make up some story about some company in the U.S. and, you know, and, but yeah, got a lot of no's because also people are really used to, like, I think through that process, I realized why a lot of products on the shelves are generally watered down because at every step of the way, there was so many opportunities or, you know, encouragements by them to take a shortcut. You know, why are you using that ingredient? Like, you know, your costs are more expensive than, you know, the prices of some of these products in market. Like, why would you do that? It's insane. And we don't want to do that. Like, that's, you know, that's changing the way we work. And, you know, so it was really, really difficult, I think, to, like, kind of stick to my guns. And
yeah, I'm sure. Because you're, you know, like, I just want to get it out there. But at the same time, you want to make sure that you're delivering on a product you're proud of.
Exactly. So after several months, I would say, You know, I ended up with a product that was very, very close to what I was making in my kitchen. I felt comfortable, you know, shipping it out. And so my first big batch went on a boat and I moved myself from Shanghai. I basically left behind my entire life in China, moved to wow. LA. Where I didn't know anybody.
Oh, wow. Just like, let's just go big. Let's just take all the risks all at once.
Right. Well, yeah, I was like, okay, well, I guess I like should move to either LA or New York. And I, you know, I'm from East Coast. I'm from Toronto. So I'm like, I'm kind of done with the winters.
Yeah,
let me just pick LA. It's also closer to Asia. So that's how I landed here. I rented an Airbnb in Silver Lake.
Amazing.
And I just kind of got to work, started building a website. You know, that was the other thing. Like, I knew from going to Expo West and seeing the people who are walking the halls that I was never going to get into that circle. Like, these are old white men mostly.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's no way. And I know going into retail stores is really expensive. So I was like, the only thing I can do, the only thing I can control is building a website on Shopify. So that's what I did. I think I paid for like a theme for like $150 and then just kind of customized it and waited for this container to arrive. I think I promised my backers that I was going to ship the products out like in October. It ended up being delayed a couple of months, so it didn't arrive until December.
Mm.
So, you know, but kept them updated. They were all really excited. And then I had to look for a 3PL, so a third-party logistics company, because I'm staying in this tiny Airbnb in Silver Lake.
Yeah.
There's no way I could, like, receive
$200,000 worth of product. Like, great.
Yeah, I mean, I would have done it, but I was like, okay, now we have thousands of backers, and so there's no way. So I have to hire somebody. So I found this 3PL that was, like, pretty reputable, and they were local in California. So I went to their warehouse, and I was like, okay, guys, I really need you to pay attention to how you pack these sauces, because I've been shipping them in China for many months. And I can tell you, you really need to pack it very well, because glass jars are super fragile.
Yeah.
Right? And it's heavy. It's like sauce. And so I was like trying to beat that into them. And they were like, yeah, no worries. We've done this before.
We do this. All the time.
Okay. Yeah. So products come in. And then this is like mid-December. And there's about, I don't know, 3,000 orders or something for them to get out. And I just noticed, like, one day they finished it all. And it was very quick. And I was like, this is odd. Like, how did you, you know, like, you're supposed to wrap them all in bubble wrap, all this stuff. But they were like, yeah, it's all done. Everything's good. And, like, 2 or 3 days later, I got my first email. And so it was a backer who had sent me, she was basically like, oh, excuse me, what is this? And it was a picture of a manila envelope, and inside was broken shards of glass with in a pool of chili oil.
A manila envelope?
Okay. And everyone had ordered in twos, like glass, like jars of two. And I was like, my heart sank.
Dropped, I'm sure.
I was just like,
my heart just dropped.
I know. I was like, I literally have worked so hard. Mm. You know, this was like all of the money went into this batch.
Yeah.
I was like, we can't redo it. And if every single jar broke this, I was so devastated, right? Like, I literally was in panic mode. I didn't know what to do. But I knew I needed to get in front of the problem. So I immediately emailed every single person and I said, look, there's something happened at this 3PL. If you got broken jars, let me know and we will make it right.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was going
to
do, but we will figure it out. And the other thing that, you know, occurred to me was like, I mean, I can't afford to refund everybody.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, there's no way.
There's no going back.
So meanwhile, I'm like dealing with the 3PL. I'm like, what the fuck happened?
Guys,
And they had no explanation. They were just like, oh, well, we weren't briefed. I was like, literally,
I briefed
to you guys.
I bubble wrap briefed.
Yes.
Okay.
So that was like my first big, you know, lesson in 3PLs. And we've had many nightmares in third-party logistics companies since then. And we've switched probably 5 times in the last 5 years. They're like, there is no perfect scenario.
Right.
You really have to handle.
No one cares as much
as you do. So what ended up happening was they had insurance, so they were able to cover and refund me for all of the broken jars. And I did have excess jars, so they were able to send out replacements. And by some miracle, only 15% of the orders were
broken. My gosh, thank goodness.
Which 15% of like 3,000 is a lot. but
it's not.
I expected
50.
A lot more. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Could be worse.
And I think through that experience, that was my first lesson in customer service.
Because right.
when I did proactively reach out, well, first of all, people were so understanding.
I'm sure.
And they always are. You know, there's always some that are like angry and unreasonable, but the majority of people were so sweet and understanding. And they were just like, oh, my God, like, we can tell you're really stressed out. Don't worry.
Yeah.
It's all good. Like, we'll let you know what happens. And I realized that that was almost the best thing that could have happened to me, because right in the beginning when I launched and when a customer was receiving the first point of contact with the product, they had a really positive experience, even though like the outcome wasn't ideal.
No, it's so
they had
true.
A really positive experience because they knew that, you know, I was there. And I was told by many of them that, like, it brought them closer to the brand.
Yeah.
It made them more supportive.
Well, the founder emailing you, like, I'm sorry. Like, yeah. I feel like anyone would be sympathetic and appreciative to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I have other stories like that, too.
You're
but
like,
that was
I have
like
400 million failure stories. But, like, yeah. this is so relatable. And I totally, totally feel you on every single level. Like, we all have these, you know, war stories, if you will. But one thing I'm curious about, the thing that caught my attention when I had first been introduced the brand was the branding. It's so specific. And I think since then we've seen brands kind of copycat a little bit of the Fly by Jing aesthetic. But like, what was in your mind when building out the brand? Because it is storytelling, right? It's bold, it's beautiful, it's, you know, but it has such a personality to it,
yeah.
which I think at the time when you launched, like, didn't really get that from food brands, I would
right.
say as much. But now it's become, you know, yeah. on the over-indexed in that
yeah.
way.
Yeah. I would say, but when we first launched, there was kind of this trend of like neutral colors mm. and, you know, kind of very dreamy sort of, you know, branding for and minimal.
I
think that was the thing, right? What you see now is not actually what we launched with.
Mm.
Initially, my only goal initially was to have a label that made someone do a double take
yeah.
and just be like, oh, why did I expect, you know, Chinese food to look different? Or why did I not expect, you know, a Chinese sauce to be neon colors? Like, it was like
right.
neon palette. And it was very cool. And people really gravitated towards it and it stood out. However, after I launched, I learned from a lot of the feedback that, I mean, people love the sauce, but as many supporters as I had just as many, if not more, detractors.
Mm.
A lot of challenges to launching a modern Asian food brand.
Right.
You know, people have a lot of ideas about what Asian food should be. Everybody has an opinion, whether they're Asian or not. And what I realized was there's this tendency for people to want to put, let's say, quote unquote, ethnic foods into a box.
Right.
It can't evolve past this box because that's not my experience of it. And therefore, it's not, quote unquote, authentic.
Right.
And it's so limiting. It's so limiting of that cuisine, of that culture, and of
yeah.
the people. Right. And so I really wanted to, like, break out of that. But initially, you know, I had all kinds of resistance from, like, you know, well, this isn't Chinese food because I've had Chinese food before and it doesn't taste like this. Or I have a Chinese girlfriend and, like, I know Chinese food.
Oh,
and, like,
God.
I've been to China once. And, like, I've been to Chinatown. And to, like, well, how dare you charge $15 for a
right.
Chinese sauce?
Yeah.
Chinese food is cheap. It's supposed to be a dollar or two. I could make this for, like, 50 cents. Like, you heard it all.
Over, yeah, all the things.
You know, which was really interesting because I kind of felt like I constantly had to
defend yourself.
Defend and
yeah.
explain. And eventually I kind of got tired and trolled them back, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, like, also...
Which sometimes is the best.
Which is
yeah.
the best. But also, I think one kind of pivotal moment was when we started to kind of hold up a mirror and say to people, like, well, why do you think that? Well, what makes you
yeah.
think that Chinese food is not worth anything or that Chinese people are not worthy of, like, making a profit from their craft, right? Like,
right.
So, you know, that was all kind of happening in the background. I was like, okay, you know what? I think, and when I did sit down with people, like, told my story, they were always like, oh, wow, I had no idea.
Right.
Like, that is so interesting. And I really get it now, you know? And so to me, it became apparent that we needed to do a rebrand
mm.
to really tell the story. Because, you know, as much as we were already we were storytelling from the very beginning, right? And we were covered in the press and we had our website and it was a D2C native brand, which is rare for food brands.
Yeah.
So I was able to use the internet to kind of tell that story, right? And you can dig deep and if you want to. But I knew that eventually we would be on store shelves where maybe the first point of contact is on a store shelf.
Yeah.
So I needed to make sure that our story and who we are is like apparent on the label.
Yeah.
So I worked with a local design agency here in LA called Dayjob. They had worked on a lot of other incredible brands, and so I really respected them. I sat down with them and just spent weeks with them, like telling them everything about who we were, what we were facing against, and even the fact that, like, this is a very personal expression of flavor, like, just like, you know, no one would go to a restaurant, like a fine dining restaurant, and question a chef, like, why is this your version of mac and cheese? It's not mac and cheese because it's not what I've tasted before.
This is not what I'm used to,
Right. But they had the tendency to do that for Chinese food over most other cuisines. And so I was like, okay, I really need to make it clear that there is space for individual expression.
Yeah.
You know, we can't put things into a box. And that these flavors are not, you know, traditional in the sense of that word, but they are very personal. And in some ways, it is more, quote unquote, authentic than anything else because of the specificity of the ingredients,
yeah, exactly.
Right? We've got 18 ingredients in the chili crisp alone that are all really meticulously sourced from Sichuan. There's no other product in the market that can say that, right?
Wow.
And it's crafted there by people from there. And, you know, it tastes of a place and a time. However, even in Sichuan, this is not something that's common, right? Because, again, it's my lens.
It's, exactly.
It's like my perspective. And so I was telling the story about how the first time I shared it with my parents or my family in Sichuan, their reaction was, oh, this is good, but this is different.
Yeah, you know? This is different.
Like, this is different. And so that's why on our jars, there's this, our tagline is not traditional, but personal.
I love.
And there is a Venn diagram. And on one side, it says Sichuan people. On the other side, it says everyone else. And in the middle, it says this tastes different. Right? So it's really capturing our story. And then if you read further, you know, I think in the midst of all that minimal branding, like we wanted to go maximalist. We wanted to kind of like, you know, go more the route of like Dr. Bronner and like Oatly, you know, and really make something
loud.
Loud, but also, you know, and informative and rooted in, you know, something, but also light and whimsical and fun. And so if you read it, it's kind of like this run-on sentence that's like food by Jing, who used to go by Jenny and blah, 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 blah. And what was actually really interesting was we launched the rebrand in the fall of 2020, which is in the midst of pandemic.
Wow, yeah.
And this was definitely not planned, but I actually also reclaimed my birth name, Jing, around the same time.
Wow.
Yeah. So when I started the company and called it Fly by Jing, I was still Jenny. Because, you know, I was Jenny for 30 years of my life.
Course.
I was very uncomfortable with my birth name because of all of the trauma around
it. Totally.
But I wanted to pay tribute to it. And I, what I didn't realize with starting this company was, you know, I mean, it was a journey of, like, coming to self.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that, like, this sauce company was going to be what was going to actually lead me there.
Yeah.
You know, and we were both, myself and the company were both growing in such tremendous ways. And I mentioned earlier that first couple of years where I kept answering to people, kind of kept justifying, it felt like I was constantly justifying my right to exist.
Right.
This company's right to exist, you know, not just like detractors online, but also investors.
Yeah.
You know, I had no money. I was bootstrapping this business. So I talked to a lot of investors. Every single one said no.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Every single one said, well, Chinese food, like, that's too niche. Like, that's never going to be mainstream. Like, that's literally what people said. And it's crazy because there's 50,000 Chinese restaurants in America. There's more than any McDonald's, Starbucks, Pizza Hut combined. You know, so in some ways, Chinese food is America's food.
Totally.
And and here is like someone kind of taking it to the next level and, you know, getting so many no's. And so during pandemic, I remember after lockdown, there's like, you know, 2 months in and I hadn't really gone out of my house. I didn't wear makeup. I didn't get out of my sweats. I was just like at home working. And well, also, it was really kind of a scary time, right?
Of course,
because
yeah.
China was locked down.
Yeah.
We had no idea. I had no idea whether I had a business left because, you know, I produce everything in China. There's like, you know, U.S.-China trade relations. There's all this anti-Asian hate. Like, it was a scary time to
be
Asian.
Of course, yeah.
And of course, at the same time, like all of the kind of criticisms online got even more blatant, even more loud,
heated,
right?
Yeah.
So it was a kind of a really interesting time for me. But I also had a lot of time by myself in solitude. And I realized one day, like, something feels different. I feel really relaxed. Like, my nervous system is like, it's like I'd taken a big breath. And I realized it was because I haven't left my house. I haven't put on makeup. I haven't had to answer to anybody.
Anyone.
Or, like, feel that need to justify my existence. I just was, you know? And that was really, like, groundbreaking for me because
yeah.
I was like, I am okay with who I am. I actually do not need anyone's validation.
Absolutely.
And it was around that time during a meditation that I was doing that I got this message very clearly that I need to go back to my birth name, Jing. And that was going to be the first step to reclaiming myself.
Wow. It is truly so personal. Like,
yeah.
I think that tagline could not be more perfect. And it is so much more than a food brand, just talking to you and hearing the stories of, you know, the adversity. I mean, gosh, starting a business. I mean, again, to your point, you've had this amazing trajectory. It looks extremely successful on paper. The roadblocks that you have had to come up against, both personally and professionally, those would take most people out. So your resilience is really amazing. And I want to go back to something that you said at the beginning is like your goal was to shift the narrative. Do you feel like you've been able to shift the narrative around Asian cuisine, condiments?
Yeah, I feel like that's been the most rewarding part of this journey. I do see the landscape changing. When you go to Expo West these days, it looks very different. Last year, or like actually earlier this year in March, it was our second year back after the pandemic. It was our second year as a brand at Expo. And even the first year, but especially this year, it was really remarkable, the change that you saw in the attendees, the people who, like all the brands that were present. There's now not just like, you know, Asian food brands. There's like multiple chili crisp brands.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, and me and like two or three other of my like fellow like founder friends who all have Asian identity driven businesses, we held a happy hour at our Fly by Jing booth one of the days that was kind of it was called the Rising Tide. It was to support like rising up and coming Asian food brands and just have a happy hour and like all the buyers would come through and we actually were able to give space to brands that were just starting out that couldn't afford to have a booth because those are expensive.
They're expensive, yeah.
They're like tens of thousands of dollars. And so we were able to give them space to like sample their stuff
cool.
to buyers. And it was so packed that like it became a fire hazard. They had to like shut it down.
They literally shut it down.
Yeah. So, I mean, every time I'm there, the number of founders that come up to our booth and tell me like, you inspired us to start what we're doing.
Yeah.
And you're paving the way. Like, that's something that I could never have planned for or imagined. We just did what we felt we had to do. But in, you know, when we were told by people, like, there's no space for you. There's no room at this table. We, like, built our own. And then we opened the doors for more people to come in. So this has been, like, incredibly, incredibly rewarding. And also what is interesting is like the whole idea of the global aisle or the ethnic aisle of the grocery store has shifted.
Oh, yeah.
When we first launched, I had kind of a chip on my shoulder about that. I was like, we don't want to be in the ethnic aisle. Like, we want to be in the hot sauce aisle. Like, we're a hot sauce, you know, and hot sauce aisles get four times as much traffic as ethnic aisles. And so I remember Target, when they first carried us, the buyer, he's very like conscientious and he was like, well, what can we do to do better? You know, we can't get rid of the ethnic aisle overnight, but we would love to do better. Tell us. And I was like, well, You can put us in both aisles. Both
I have
aisles.
I have an idea.
Give us double placement, please.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he was like, well, we can't do that, but we can put you in the hot sauce aisle and let's see how it goes, right? And so I had initially launched Fly By Jing in the Asian aisle. And then halfway through the year, we moved into the hot sauce aisle. And I was like really excited to see the results.
Yeah.
And what we actually found was really surprising to me. We saw that the sales were much higher in the Asian aisle than the hot sauce aisle.
Interesting.
And that was really interesting, right? Because you know there's like way more foot traffic there. But what I realized was that we made the Asian aisle a destination.
Yeah.
And kind of reinvigorated it. And also along with other brands like ours that we've helped to lift up that are becoming introduced into the aisle more and more, we're really like creating this halo.
Yeah.
And making the global aisle a cool
a destination
place.
To go. Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
So
even just me personally, I've seen so much change in that aisle, you know, since the beginning and so many cool young brands that are getting that placement they deserve with really good products. It's mm-hmm. not, you know, it's really amazing. So tell us about the book.
So it's my first cookbook. It's called The Book of Citron Chili Crisp. It's a very personal story about my journey of building this company and getting to here. But it's not just about, and it's about this condiment. Like it's told through the lens of this condiment that yeah. I think is so amazing and versatile and you know, a conduit for like self-expression, right? Which is, it has been for me. But it's more than just the condiment as well. A lot of the recipes in it are inspired by my dishes when I was cooking my supper club. So I called it sort of Sichuan soul food. It's very soulful. It's very comforting. It's the flavors are incredible, but it's applied in a way that I think makes sense for our modern lives.
Amazing. You know? And you're opening a restaurant here in Los Angeles?
Yes. So everything's happening at once.
Truly. Sounds like you do that a lot.
Yeah. So, you know, our mission at Fly By Jing is, you know, as you said, to evolve culture through taste and, you know, expand palates and minds. And so I think this restaurant that I'm opening with my business partner, Stephanie, it's called Swa. It's very much like has the same mission. Swa is a Sichuanese dialect word, which is a very like endearing kind of term that means like joyful, to be playful and have fun. And it's kind of a word that if you're growing up as a kid in Sichuan, you use a lot. And so we wanted to, so Stephanie is also from Sichuan.
Amazing.
And her family is from California, but they've been operating Sichuan restaurants in LA for many years.
Wow.
And so we felt it was like a perfect way to kind of come together and, you know, bring her family's operational background with like, you know, the flavors of Fly By Jing and combine these flavors of our tradition with a reflection of how we live today. So we're both living in Southern California. We wanted to really highlight the amazing organic produce that exists here. So it's like, imagine like, you know, Fly By Jing powered flavors meets organic California farmers market, like ingredients.
Delicious. I'm starving now. But also a great full circle moment, saying that you started in a restaurant with a partner.
Yeah.
And now you're fully back and in a different place. And now you're Jing.
Absolutely.
And it's a whole new experience. So I loved your hot take. I think we've come full circle that failure really is kind of the key to success, it sounds mm-hmm. like, and that all the dots connect. Can you tell everyone where they can follow you and, of course, buy the book?
The book is out now everywhere that books are sold. And then it's called The Book of Sichuan Chili Crisp. You can find our products at flybyjing.com or at flybyjing on Instagram. And I am at Jing Theory.
Amazing. Thank you so
Thank
much,
you.
Jing. Thanks for listening to this episode of Work Party. If you like what you heard, follow, leave a review, rate the pod, or slide into my DMs. Check out our membership program, Insiders, designed for go-getters and game changers like you. Sign up today at createcultivate.com. Follow us at Work Party and at Jacqueline R. Johnson on all platforms. And be sure to head to createcultivate.com to keep up with all the latest events, content, and community designed to help you level up your life and career.
Please note that this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services. Individuals on the show may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to in this episode.